Welcome to this last episode of the KICKS podcast series, Classicists in Transition. For this final episode, we talk with Emilia Mataix-Ferrandis, who is a postdoctoral researcher at Helsinki University. Emilia really embodies the essence of transition, as her work on seafaring and mobility in the Roman Mediterranean merges the fields of Roman law and classical archaeology. She obtained two PhDs, one at the University of Alicante and one at the University of Southampton, and she was a visiting fellow within the ESDEP program at Ghent University this year. In this episode, she talks about her surprising career in classics within the theme of progress. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
You are in Ghent right now, I guess, as a visiting scholar working with Kuhn. So maybe you can tell us where you're coming from and what you're doing in Ghent and how you're finding it. And
Thank you. Yes, I come from Helsinki University, and what I'm working here is basically the same as I was doing there, but it's good to have, you know, your nice library and the expertise of Kuhn, because I work a lot on the Roman economy, and that is a field that is not really popular in Finland, to be honest, or in my group of work. So what I'm working on now, it's the book of my PhD, that it's about Roman trade, basically, but it's more about how Roman ports of the Imperial Mediterranean work in terms of procedures, you know. So what I did for the PhD was to study basically merchandise. It's what I study is like a lot of inscriptions on merchandise and labelings, and then trying to see what that has to say about contract procedures and how it talks about the general, you know, frame of functioning of these ports. And Ghent is lovely. I really like the city and I really like the library and everything, but it's true that, and I'm sure you get this a lot of times, it's difficult to judge a city nowadays because with COVID, everything is kind of like a ghost city. And yeah. I imagine Ghent must be really lively as a student city. And now, well, the good thing is like I'm practically the only one every day in the library. So it's all for me and that is great. But it's true that it's a bit sad, you know, like for example, not going to the department and actually, you know, I imagine there you may have like seminars weekly or practically weekly and not being part of that academic part of the grant. It's a shame. It's a shame, but it's great to be here otherwise.
Yeah, we heard that with other visiting scholars or expat colleagues. We heard the same kind of stories. It's very difficult to find cohesion in these times if you're arriving in a new town, in a new environment. So it's difficult to make new contacts, to meet your colleagues, but even to make new friends. So I guess it must be the same for you, that it's all a little bit more artificial. Probably because I think you're now staying 3 months in Ghent, because you were invited by or you applied for a fellowship within the Structural Determinants of Economic Performance program by Koen Verboven. So you're here for 3 months, and how are you seeing the following 3 months? What would you take away from Ghent, and what are you expecting from the Structural Determinants program? How is your work going with Kuhn? How does this fit into your long-term research program, this visit in Ghent?
Well, basically what I wanted kind of COVID contributes to this. I wanted a bit of peace of mind, you know, to basically work because, I keep on working for Helsinki and I am still involved in many things there, but it's true that here I get less distracted. And also, as I told you, like many, Helsinki has been quite restrictive, so I don't have access to the library there. When here, actually, you have all the reference. And even if sometimes just to be in this kind of research environment, you know, like at least to be able to, if I need a reference, just go there and pick it. Even if some days I'm there, I'm just writing and I don't really consult anything. But this kind of environment really helps a lot. With Kuhn, also we have seen each other like a couple of times since I'm here, because also he's not going to the office because he cannot work there. Yeah. But we now it's more like this peripathetic, you know, kind of like a touch. When it's not raining, that also, I'm sorry, but the climate of Brussels, of Belgium in general is like not accompanying this COVID measures, because you need to.
I know. But we were very unlucky because we had the worst and the wettest January in years. So you also there came a little bit at a bad time. We have the coldest winter in years, and then first we had the wettest January in years. So it's not really representative.
Yeah. So yeah, no, but as I told you, it's more. I at the beginning when I applied for that grant of SCDP, I wanted to do a paper, you know, and I wanted to write a paper that in fact is in my head. It's something that came out when I was doing the PhD and I didn't write about. But then because it got postponed because of COVID, I supposedly was going to come here in October, but I think the situation was quite complicated at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Meanwhile, I passed the peer review process of Oxford University Press. And then when I came here, I told Kuhn, you know, I think I'm going to work on the book because this is more urgent now, you know, that the also because I have not really worked on the paper at all and I will need to start from scratch. And he was really accommodating. And it's always, you know, sometimes I think when you are kind of in Europa or your own path, you don't really need that much more than a conversation of key things and can be inspiring to keep you continuing. So what I hope is like these 3 months will help me to place exactly the structure that I already have and to feed the ideas and, you know, get a bit of boost on the frame of every chapter.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
And that's so your monograph, is that the one from your PhD, like it reworked from your PhD thesis?
Yeah, well, I am a kind of a weird case. I have 2 PhDs.
Okay.
Wow. I don't know. I don't look like, but maybe I'm a bit crazy or masochistic. I don't know. I did a PhD in Roman law. I'm a lawyer in background. I studied law. And that book, I recently finished it. It's going to Brill. Also, when you mentioned Brill, I think like, yeah, I understand what you mean. And I like it. they have been super nice with me, but it's a lot of editing process by yourself.
Yeah.
So that is the book of my first PhD. And then I did the second PhD on the Portus Lehmann project. That was an ERC advanced grant led by Simon Kay and Pascal Arnaud. And I did the PhD in archaeology there. And then this is the book I'm working on.
This is like the perfect introduction to the theme of this podcast, transition, because you went from one PhD to another, and then from a PhD in law to a PhD in classical archaeology or Roman archaeology, where are those two interests coming from? Why you were interested in law, and what made you do the jump or make the jump towards Roman archaeology then?
Well, that's why I proposed to Alice on the topic of progress, because to be honest, it has been like an organic progress for me. Like I did my PhD in Roman law and I was working already on a punishment of shipwreck, you know, provocation of shipwrecks, and based on some one ruling from the Republican period, but there are other comps on that. And for that, I had the chance of like working in Sicily with a unique professor who is also a lawyer and an underwater archaeologist, and he introduced me to diving and to archaeological evidence, you know, to what I was studying. And then, you know, I finished my PhD, and the opportunities that I was, you know, I had for postdocs, they were not really attractive. Basically, they were kind of badly paid, because in Italy they get assignments that are really badly paid sometimes, yeah. And I was not seeing that I fitted in the Spanish scenario for what I wanted to do. So then Simon contacted me for this position, and, you know, I thought, well, you know, it's another PhD, but I was not only lead for economical reasons, because the pay was better than what we were for me in the Department of Sicily, but also because I thought, you know, I wanted to develop more my skills as an archaeologist, because I'm working already in this stuff, and doing this, I'm sure I will learn a lot. And, you know, there's always this problem of intrusism. I felt, you know, if I do a PhD in archaeology, then they cannot really tell me, you know, you don't know anything what you're talking about. At least I will have something. And I have to say that the experience was very beneficial, because I started working more with epigraphy, even if I'm kind of like a mixture of a researcher. You know, I will not call myself an epigrapher. I will not call myself a pure archaeologist or an underwater archaeologist, but I'm kind of a hybrid, or a humanist, if you want to call it, or something like that.
Well, that's very interesting because in I think two episodes ago, we were talking ourselves about how becoming an expert in your field and how from the outside that is often people see you as, oh, she or he has all the knowledge and she's the expert and the expert mind. But the process of becoming an expert when you're trying to become one yourself, it's like you say, it's a very natural one. It's a very organic one in the sense of you're not always planning to become that expert, but on the way you choose your pathway and you're like incorporating different elements, and that is how you create yourself as someone expert or knowledgeable in a certain field. But it's very interesting to realize that it is that organic process and that it's mostly a combination of choices that you made at a certain moment and a certain time in your life. And I think that's very well reflected in what you just said about coming from Roman law, going to Roman archaeology, and just following your interests in a way. Yeah,
it's been really fascinating. But the problem is like sometimes this kind of, that is the problem of like, I don't know if I will call myself maybe like an expert or getting towards to be an expert on like Roman law and the sea or something like that in a way, you know. But even then it's complicated because many of my peers that is a new field, you know, like now there's more awareness among the community of Roman law that we need to look at the material evidence, that we need to look at archaeology to actually understand how people lived and how law reflects in society. But before that, it was so complicated, you know, and it's still an ongoing thing, you know. They will tell you, what does an amphora can tell me about a legal stuff, you know? It's just an economic indicator, right? And I'm like, well, no, not exactly that, you know. There are many things that to be told about that, but I don't know. It's a path ongoing as well. Not as organic, I would say.
No, but it is something that is changing. I have experienced myself within the field of Roman economic archaeology, is that we are getting used to looking at an object or a source from different angles and not just focus on the fact, oh, this is an amphora, this will say something about trade or something about the direction of trade, but that it can actually say much more. And I think that is something very, it's becoming much more in vogue in at least in Roman archaeology. I think that's a very good thing, to like to step outside your own comfort zone. Let's see at other stuff as well from our perspectives, because perhaps sometimes someone is not seeing it because he's too focused on his own research, but then someone else steps in from another perspective and say, oh, you could also look at this artifact or this context from this kind of angle. And I think that's a very enriching experience, but it's a way of doing research that is still in a very early phase. I think it's something that will and need to mature in the course of the following decades, I guess.
Also that sort of this sort of relates to something else that we talked about, I guess, two episodes ago, about on the way to becoming an expert, do you become a specialist or do you become a generalist, and having all these different sort of feathers to your bow. I think it sort of helps, you know, push the field along, and being able to combine archaeology and epigraphy and law and economy. I think that's the only way we can make new discoveries and develop the field, is sort of to bring all these things together.
And so I was wondering, in you mentioned it already briefly, you studied in Sicily. You did your PhD in Sicily or in Italy or only in Spain? How was it? Because I have the feeling that you have been traveling a lot and that you have been working in different countries. So I was wondering how is that pathway from where you come from, and how would you describe the way towards academia, and how did this kind of pathway develop itself through your various PhDs, but even before, in masters or in your education? How did you now end up here being that specialist in Roman law and the sea?
yeah, if you can call it that. I don't know, you know, sometimes I think, how did I get here? And I'm like, wow, I even thought I was gonna come here, you know. And I'm kind of sometimes envious of my colleagues that this, since they were little, they wanted to be archaeologists, because I was like, yeah, you know, I've always liked this idea of like treasure hunting and stuff like that. That is a horrible way of putting it, but when I was a kid, you always look in your garden.
It's true.
But no, in fact, you know, I finished law, and I already like a lot Roman law. I had collaborated with my department in back in Spain and stuff. But I always been like this kind of person of like, yeah, I like this, but I'm gonna keep my feet on the earth, because even my director in Spain, he told me, you know, it's very difficult to find a job. So, you know, I keep, I mean, so I used to work as a corporate lawyer before while getting my master's and stuff. And then at some point, you know, with the PhD, when I started in Spain, and it was gonna be a co-tutel between Valencia, where I come from, and Palermo in Sicily. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, having a full-time job as a lawyer and doing a PhD was something that was really killing completely my spirits, killing my soul, my everything. So I decided to drop corporate life because I didn't really like it very much, I have to say. Yeah, my parents, my father was very surprised, like, what are you doing this, you know, like a good job in a maritime law bar and stuff. Anyway, so I dropped that, and then, yeah, I was at the beginning in Valencia, and then I went to Sicily, and I was there for more than a year, also, like, then coming back and forth after that year and stuff. And, yeah, really, that changed a lot my perception, because, I don't know, this... already my professor was someone like he had like this very fresh approach, even if he already was a man of like 60 something years old. Mm-hmm. He had this fresh approach of law to law to we really need to look at the real material sources and stuff that I have never seen, and that helped me a lot. And then after that, with the other PhD, it was the project was held between Southampton and Lyon in France. So yeah, I was moving also towards, and that was also like a very weird experience because of the different approaches to academia that they had. Because okay, the academic schools of Spain and Italy could be more or less similar, you know, in the kind of like medieval approach of like your director is kind of your master, and you need to follow them, and you are tied into this person for life, but In England is this approach of like your, I don't know, like you don't even call them professor something, you call them Simon or Luke or whatever, it's weird. And when they give you feedback, it's always this kind of, I'm sorry to say the word, if I know if I can say this in this podcast, this kind of shit sandwich of like, they tell you, oh, you've done a great job, blah, 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 this is very nice, bad, and then, but I know that you're working a lot, that. Then when I was going to Lyon and I was having meetings with my supervisor there, it was 2 hours of suffering, because I think the French have this approach of like, they need to destroy you and then you will be reborn from your ashes. And it's good because it makes you work if you are enough strong. But then the approach between English and French was kind of like a very disruptive in the way of working, to be honest. But I survived and I learned a lot. So I guess... all these changes made me what I am now, so I'm happy with that.
I think you're probably quite unique and somebody who's had so many different academic experiences in Spain, Italy, England, France, and then Finland, and now Belgium. How have you learn from them? Like what aspects of the different systems do you sort of apply to your own work, or maybe even looking further into the future, if you want to continue with the academic life and have your own students that you supervise and you mentor, are there aspects of these different academic climates that you would want to emulate or that you'd want to destroy, or have you thought of that?
I think in terms of approaching students, I am generally very down to earth. I would like to be more formal in general, but that is not really my nature. So I'm normally very, I don't know, like, for example, in Helsinki, in the first institute I was working, they had this thing called winter school. That is, it's 3 days where they have like special workshops for master and PhD students, and they are based on one topic. Like last year was public speaking, and this year is group collaboration and stuff like that. And the first year that it was academic writing, they asked me to participate. And, you know, there were these big professors in the panel, and then there was me, that was, I was the youngest. And basically I was being super honest with them, telling them my own struggles. It was kind of like a stand-up comedy in a way, because I was telling them about when you get rejected a paper, and don't worry because that happens to everyone. And the director of this institute told me, like, you know, I want you to come next year, because you were telling them all this, that de-dramatizing these experiences, because you already live them, that I think they feel very close. And on the one hand, that makes me less, I think, formal, and it makes me look that sometimes I'm not serious, but I'm bloody serious when I tell these experiences, even if I mock about them, you know. So yeah, no, this last year with public speaking, I was also like telling them, if at the end it was kind of like you know, like an AA meeting, but for academic,
you know, Academics Anonymous.
Academics Anonymous, yeah, or something yeah. like that. And I think this year is going to become the same. So I'm kind of like becoming known in that winter school of like the lady who tells the truth.
Well, I think that's a very healthy approach in academia. It's in the sense, but of course, it's a very serious business, and we all like our work and we like to do it really well. But also in the end, you have to make fun, and you don't have to take yourself too seriously, because I see a lot of young scholars in every stage of their career who are so focused on getting it right and on being the perfect scholar and on actually responding to the kind of pressure that you sometimes feel inside academia, that they completely freeze, that they actually forget that they're actually in the end just doing a job, they are just performing a job or a research. But it's also the entanglement between that kind of academic research and your personal life, because we're all very committed to what we're doing, and the topics that we choose are very much close perhaps to our own passions and to our own interests, so it makes it at the same time very personal career. And then, especially then, it's very important, I think, to have that healthy mentality of not always taking yourself too seriously while you're doing a serious job, as that helps you surely along the way. And we've talked a lot about in our previous episodes about that, actually the conflict sometimes, or the difficulty of combining our jobs with a personal life. And especially because a lot of our tasks require to go abroad, to do different stuff, to work in various environments. So I wonder also here is how you experience that, I wouldn't say conflict, but I wouldn't at least that the relation between a personal life and a work life inside academia, coming from Sicily, coming from Spain, going to Helsinki, Southampton, I can imagine it's not always so easy. I'm wondering about that.
It's not easy for sure. And also sometimes I will feel like, okay, the job itself is challenging, because it's true that we need to apply. And sometimes I feel like these academic contracts in some that are nowadays, you know, are really cruel with people with families, or to people to start a family or something like that, because sometimes they are like just 1 year. And okay, you can say, oh, you know, it's 1 year away on something, but it would be even better if they have like contracts, like, I don't know, in Germany, they have these lecture positions of like 6 years, at least that you can settle something. Yeah. And even more wonderful for your network, because you get to a place, like when I go to Helsinki, I started at the beginning 2 years, then I got another third year. And it's good because I'm really enforcing the network I had there. If it was being one, it would have been 1 year, would not have been the same experience. So in that sense, it's cruel. But also I think of another component, and I have experienced that myself, and I'm sure you will got that sometimes, is that you are your worst enemy sometimes, because the problem of our work is like, we never really disconnect. I mean, sometimes I will be shopping in the supermarket and I will be thinking of like, oh, you know, in this chapter, I'm going to do this or that, or because I work a lot with labelings, even if I'm looking a bottle of wine and it says, embouteillé en propriété, and I will think, oh, this is good. I need a picture of this for my presentation or something like that. So it's never disconnecting and stuff. And in the sense of like, sometimes I will be on a Sunday and I will be feeling bad because I have not worked in the whole day. And I think lots of us got that. And it's very difficult sometimes to put your own boundaries and say, no, you know, it's the weekend, I'm not going to work unless there's a deadline, it's super necessary or something like that. So I'm even myself, I'm learning now this, you know, I'm trying not to do that. But unfortunately, now I will say that deadlines are going against me. So I don't know. Even if I was, it's a bad time to set boundaries. But I guess it's an enemy that we got that. But yeah, now it's true that with COVID, what I felt is like many people has reconciled a bit their personal life because you're able to stay more at home and then you can have like more like a life with your partner or with a family or something. But
It's indeed something I think a lot of people in our business in our branch struggle with, also because you have those short contracts, and that not only shortens your time of building your network, of settling in a certain place, but it also creates that mentality of, okay, also now when you're here in Ghent for 3 months, so I only have 3 months, so I have to get all that work done in 3 months, so I'm going to work as much as possible every day that I can to finish that work, and that's a mentality that's linked to those short-term contracts, and it will not, I think, get better anytime soon, because contracts are getting more difficult to get also now. They are getting shorter because you have to perform not commonly in 3 years, but perhaps in 2 years or in 1 year. And it's a bit, it's a bit of a result of how the system has evolved in the last couple of years. And that's something that we noticed in a lot of our conversations in this podcast, that people in different contexts and in different levels find it quite difficult to combine their personal life with their work life, or are facing the moment when they say, well, I'll have to make a choice. If I want to continue having an academic life, I will need to accept that I have to go abroad, I have to have different positions after each other in various universities or various contexts, or I will go and say, well, I'm going to abolish the academic life. I'm not going to continue. I have preferred to have like a family life or a job at home and a steady environment. So that's a conflict that regularly pops up, and especially among young academics, I guess.
I feel that also, because, you know, like, one of the boundaries I have set for myself in this past year is like, I don't think I'm going to apply for contracts of 1 year. Basically, because you spend half of the year applying for things, you know, so you don't really get anything. And at the end, you keep selling promises, you know, you will say, oh, I will write, or you spend like 1 month on that paper or something like that, and the rest applying. So it's a bit of a pain.
Also something that we have discussed in previous episodes, is the amount of time that you spend applying for the next job during your current job. And it has come so far sometimes, I think, I've experienced myself. I have the feeling that applying for another job is me doing research. in a sense, I'm doing my research when I'm applying for a job, because they already want to hear a lot about so much about your project, especially sometimes in the Belgian system, that you practically have to solve all the questions that you're actually asking in your project. So sometimes I feel myself doing research while doing an application. Say, well, yeah, this is the time I have. So I'm, and it has its advantages. You really get it does help you mentally to move forward in your thinking and in your mental framework of your work. But as you say, it has surely a lot of disadvantages as well. And the first one being that you're not actually able to spend the amount of time that you wish on the project that you're getting paid for. So that's a frustrating, I think.
I think it's a very healthy approach. I want to think it's like kind of research in a way. And it's true that it helps you put, you know, like ideas that you're going to use later and stuff. But for example, another thing that I find frustrating in comparison for when I was working in a corporate law, I mean, if I ever go back, it will not be to corporate. I think it will be for small thing related to law. But in terms of like things to be immediate, you know, like with applications, for example, you apply for ERC or one of these biggest schemes, and you spend, I mean, when I applied for ERC a couple of years ago, I really spent so much time writing this thing. It was like really like a research paper, really long. And then you wait 6 months and then you get, well, in my case, yeah, it was like that. And I don't know, it's like very frustrating to wait so long. And also because also sometimes it has become so competitive that it's, I mean, and it's subjective in the end. So it's like, well, how do I know if I'm doing right or not? Because sometimes the feedback you will get is like, this is wonderful, but there are these shortcomings because we have decided that these are shortcomings that maybe other person will not consider that shortcomings. So it's a bit frustrating. I sometimes feel like I have like sand going a bit beneath my fingers, you know.
But it is that problem of an extremely competitive environment, and a lot of people tend to look at it from a very personal point of view, again, because it's something that you're really passionate about, and so you're easily led into belief then when you're not getting a scholarship or you're not passing on to the next round, that you have failed. So that you have failed to in your capabilities and your abilities to do research, or that you're not being valued enough. But in the end, as you say, that really hasn't anything to do with it, because it's so competitive that you have a bunch of very good proposals and a lot of proposals together, and they're all practically at the same level. And so it becomes some kind of a chance game. It's just a lottery. And that is very frustrating as well, because indeed, not everyone can have that grant, and we're all practically at the same level. So that's a very frustrating aspect of the modern way in which academia works. And I can certainly feel your comments about ERC, because I'm applying myself at the moment. So I'm writing a proposal at the moment for an ERC starting grant, and it's actually basically taking all my time. It's not something that you write. It's just a couple of hours after work. It is indeed thinking out a complete research paper, a proposal, a way of doing stuff, even for the next decades or so. So it is research, but it's amazing how much time you have to put in these kind of proposals. And then of course, indeed, the waiting of will it go past to the next round? Will I get, how far will I get? That almost takes a year, that entire process. So it's like, and I often compare this guy that working academia, and you have to be careful about this, is in the sense it can become some kind of an eternal waiting room. Because you're constantly applying and then you're living in that application time. So now I have a year waiting for the result. And so as in life also, I think it's very important, and we talked about in our previous episode about that aspect, to be really in the moment, in the sense of even when you're applying for another job, don't get really drawn too much into that mental tube of like, I am in the waiting room for a scholarship. Just try to do the research that you're doing now, and don't look too much behind it. But that's a very difficult balancing act, I think, for most of us. Yeah,
I think so. But even if I said that, I have to say that not everything obviously is negative. We are so lucky to really develop our research in something we really love and we are passionate about. So this is really beautiful of our job.
And even just like, it's sort of a double-edged sword, I think, because as you say, it's hard to ever turn off. You know, you're always thinking, you always feel guilty if you're not working. But on the other side of it, our job is so flexible. I mean, if you work in a different sector, you know, I guess a little bit less now that it's everyone's at home office and COVID. But one of the things that I just love the most about doing academia is that I'm my own boss. You know, I have to get things done, but they can be done whenever. They just have to be done. But, you know, you can work early in the morning, then take a break. Then like that I think is just so, we're so lucky to be able to do that. And I think some people are good at, even in academia, working sort of 9 to 5, but I've never been able to do that. But just having the flexibility of, okay, now I'm feeling really inspired, so I'm going to write now, or okay, it's not working right now, so I'm just going to go for a walk now. So I think we're very lucky to be so flexible and free and but it can also be bad, because it means that sometimes, you know, you don't take a weekend, but
it's really that double cutting sword, in the sense of you have that immense freedom, which is fantastic, And at the same time, it gives you a great amount of responsibility, because it is really you that decides what you are going to do that day. And if you don't do it, you don't do it. But in the end, it will be your responsibility. And also there, I found a lot of young scholars that are struggling with that aspect of academia. But when you were talking about progress earlier in this episode, if you look at yourself in your career, in your life, and you look towards the future, and you can look towards the future in academia or future in your own personal life, how do you see there the aspect of progress? Do you think that there, of which progress is there still to be made in what you're doing at this moment and inside academia? What are your thoughts on that?
There's always a progress to be done, especially because, and that relates with our field. I mean, study antiquity is so complex. You always need extra capacities, you know, then you realize that you need to know more about the Greek or know more Latin, or you need to know more about this concrete field of epigraphy that it's like so specific or something like that. But in that sense, on technicalities, yeah, I feel like, well, I hope that the future I will learn more things. In fact, that relates to one of your previous questions. One of the good things I thought of coming to Ghent is because you know so much about, techniques to study the Roman economy, you know, like you have so many different programs that you use, so many approaches that I have not used myself. I'm more like a classical scholar of, you know, I analyze material culture, I analyze legal text, and then I combine them in a way, you know, and stuff. But this is, you know, this kind of thing. And in a way, I think, how do I see myself? I think I hope that with years of like trying to explain myself, you know, and I'm feeling like with the years I'm becoming, for example, clearer on the way of explaining my ideas. I am hoping, and also with teaching, this is a continuous progress, because every year, and that is the problem also of the different contracts, that in all the different contracts I have been teaching very different subjects. So I have been teaching Roman law for several years, that's true. But on the other, you know, like, for example, in Helsinki, I'm teaching the most bombastic and weird topics sometimes, you know, like long distance trade from the big scope or a perspective of maritime archaeology or something like that. So every time is challenging. And what I'm feeling is like, okay, the topics will be different. But what I'm trying is to build a bit my way of making myself understandable for the students. And the same with communications in public with conferences, and the same with papers. So I feel like at the end of this path is making me become a person who is able to explain her ideas clearly, you know, in a way. And I am really thankful for academia for that, you know, even if supposedly as a lawyer, I should have been able to explain my ideas clearly before, you know.
I think interesting aspect of our work is indeed the communication, the how to explain what we are doing, not only to an audience of students, but also to the broader audience. That is something that has become very fashionable and also very needed within especially human sciences, is that we step out of our own comfort zones and try to explain the use also of what we are doing to that broader audience. And there, I think your work is a beautiful example of how you can indeed combine different aspects of like something as law, apply that to the Roman world, and then try to combine this with archaeological aspects of that topic, and then practically turn it back to the world of today and to other contexts. So that, I think, is a really a really healthy approach, a really fruitful approach to doing something in the humanities, actually. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that has a bit affected the way I studied trade, because one of the things that is still an ongoing discussion is like, if actually what text we have of Roman law, you know, I'm not talking about papyri, like documentary papyri, I'm talking more about what were the text, the typical text of the digest that were compiled in the 6th century in these codes. These are texts of like mostly like administrative jurists that work for the empire, and they were writing their comments on Roman law. And in a way, that reminds me of like when I was working as a lawyer, we have our technicalities. And if I show like a paper to my mother, she will say like, can you translate this to me? Because I don't understand this jargon. And when I work with trader, one of my main questions is like, is this actually rulings made for these traders? Are they actually aware of these things? And then it's when you get to the material evidence and you see, okay, sometimes I feel like these guys are, you know, they create the biggest scheme, but then things in practice work in a bit of a different way. And I'm really interested in this part of things, okay? Like the big frame and then what happens underneath that. So
yeah, so the relationship between theory and practice. That's something that you see in a lot of aspects of Roman archaeology or Roman history, is that the different aspect that you read about in the classical text and also in the agronomic literature, for example, how to do farming, how to organize a farm, and then you start applying those concepts to archaeological realities, and you realize that most of them actually do not conform to what is said in the texts, and that I think is a very important wake up call, in a sense that when you're reading a text, you're only having one little bit, one small part of a certain society, and think there the synergy between archaeology and history, that's exactly what we can achieve, in the sense of how can we make sense of our archaeological data by using texts, but also how can we broaden the meanings or the data that we have from our texts and place them within that broader view that we can create through archaeological materials. And that exchange, I think, is very healthy. And in the end, it is also the one of the core focal points of the SDEP program, I guess, that was initiated by Koen. So yeah, I think your research is a perfect example for that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I think also this sort of seeking to see what was actually happening on the ground, like it's such an important, I guess not totally new, but a little bit new strain in classics, and it's something that I'm really interested in myself, and my next project is going to be doing that, because my background is very, you know, dealing with elite literary texts, and that's sort of, you know, traditional classics. Okay, what can we learn about the elite? And I think this, like reading them against the grain, and in my new project, I'm going to, you know, start to use epigraphy and understand, okay, this is what these texts are saying, how is it reflected in, you know, normal people's experiences? And yeah, I think this is, yeah, it's incredibly exciting to see the difference between, and the tensions between these different sort of like levels
I guess, I mean, this kind of like this new turning point as well, right? Like to realize that, okay, most of our sources are coming from some status of society, and then we need to mm-hmm. look further to understand what is actually happening to people who were like us. So not writing the history, but, you know, living within that frame. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Emilia. I think this was a very nice interview. Thank you very much for being with us on this podcast.